Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the Defence Authorisation Bill that the President has threatened to veto, with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff and went public with his knowledge of torture approved by the Bush administration. We'll look into provisions in the bill that appear to increase the role of Guantanamo Bay rather than close the place that has become synonymous with torture, as well as provisions that allow for American citizens to be arrested on U.S. soil and be held indefinitely without trial. We'll also look into other aspects of the bill that appear to make a war with Iran very likely and drive up the price of oil in an election year. Then we'll look into rumors swirling around in Venezuela that Hugo Chavez is close to death. Javier Corrales, a professor of political science at Amherst College and author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, joins us. With presidential elections scheduled for October of next year, we'll examine the likelihood that the terminally ill leader will not run. But without any clear succession in place, the possibility of civil unrest looms. Then finally, we'll explore the role of student debt in the Occupy movement with Andrew Ross, who's a professor of social and cultural analysis at NYU and one of the organizers of the Occupy student debt campaign. With student debt reaching $1 trillion this year and the White House apparently buckling under pressure from well-connected lobbyists representing the for-profit colleges, reform of a $30 billion predatory industry that more often than not provides students with a worthless education while saddling them with a mountain of debt is not likely, thanks to the industry's friends on Capitol Hill who are allowed to make an enormous profits as private enterprises that are 90% funded by the taxpayer. And joining us now is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was retired from the United States Army as a colonel and formerly was Chief of Staff to the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. He also serves as the Deputy Director and Director of the U.S. Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. And in 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William and Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And it does seem extraordinary that the very place that President Obama, candidate Obama in the election campaign of 2008, said he wanted to close Guantanamo, which has become synonymous with torture. And of course, the most egregious aspect of that is that the world's unsavory dictators like Gaddafi and Mugabe and now Assad in Syria are now able to say, well, you know, why are you complaining about torture? The Americans do it. It's been a terrible blow to the United States. But in this defense authorization bill, it feels like instead of closing Guantanamo, it's going to come back with more business than usual.
It is a strange development. And the most bizarre aspect of it, as I followed the debate on the Hill in the Congress, was the Congress's acquiescence in it. As a matter of fact, I was on the Hill last week speaking with a Republican congressman whose views I respect, and he said he couldn't believe what was happening. He simply couldn't believe that, in his words, only six members of a 535-member body actually registered any objections to this aspect of the NDAA, which, for all practical purposes, destroys Posse Comitatus, which is the law, of course, that keeps the United States Armed Forces from interfering with law enforcement or with anything in the domestic arena, and takes us back to the days of Reconstruction, when we put Northern soldiers in the South and essentially ruled the South. This is not the way we should be going.
Well, how did this happen, though, given that the other provisions, particularly the provisions in the bill that I think are likely to make or could make war with Iran much more likely and therefore drive up the price of oil in an election year, which you think would be completely counterintuitive for the Democrats? Why did so many Democrats in the Senate support the aspects of these bills?
This is a train, I think, that once it gets moving, and I call it the national security train, once it gets moving and politicians on both sides of the aisle begin to vie with each other for being more aggressive than the other, it loses all sense of reality and sanity. We will find the president saying things like he did the other day, which just blew me over, essentially bragging about having killed bin Laden in order to contest a claim on the opposition side that he was an appeaser. This is the kind of thing that happens in Washington. This is the kind of thing that gets us in deep, deep trouble fast when these two sides, without any restraints whatsoever, begin to try to outdo each other in terms of national security for purely political gain. The White House does it with this president, I think, with the almost arrogant assumption that at the end of the day they can control it. I think they're going to find out differently. I think we're on an inexorable march to war with Iran, just as we were in, say, 2001 and 2 toward war with Iraq. It seems to me now that we're just going there.
Well, isn't there a game going on here, though, Colonel Wilkerson, in as much as there have been rumors for some time and threats, and many of the top intelligence officials in Israel went public, the former head of Mossad, Maya Dagan, former chief of staff of the military. I mean, you can't get more senior people going public saying that they were concerned that Netanyahu was going to attack Iran. What appears to be happening behind the scenes is that everybody is sort of trying to stop Israel from attacking Iran because of the terrible consequences. But my assumption in return is the Israelis are saying, okay, if you don't want us to do this, then either you have to do it or you and the Saudis have to do it. And isn't there kind of a Cold War going on here that at the end of the day may be a psychological operation to force the U.S. And the West to have greater sanctions because war is a catastrophe, right?
I think it is. I can paint a pretty catastrophic picture for what might result from yet another use in Western Asia of U.S. military force in an overt fashion that eventually would call on, I would guess, somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 U.S. forces, depending on how many of our allies we could get to go in with us, because you're not going to do anything with bombs. All you're going to do is irritate the people on the ground with the bombs and make them work faster. So ultimately, if you want to bring positive results, if that's even possible, you want to put troops on the ground. And in a country the size of Iran, with the population of Iran, you're talking about at least 500,000. Incidentally, you're also talking about bringing back the draft, because there is absolutely no way we could get 500,000 men and women under arms to mount the Arabian and Persian peninsula and conduct this kind of a conflict, which will take at least a decade, maybe longer, without that number of troops. We can't do it volunteer-wise. So think about conscription coming back. Every American citizen from San Francisco to New York should be considering that right now, because that's what we're talking about if we start yet another war in Western Asia. But there's a sober view back here on both sides of the aisle again that this is all rhetoric, and it's rhetoric designed to bring the Iranians eventually to the negotiating table with a better, if you will, disposition to agree to our terms. If you know anything about the Persians, you know anything about Tehran, modern history, ancient history, this is exactly the opposite of the way we should be operating, but no one's going to accuse the United States, especially its diplomats, of late, of having a real sense of the, quote, enemy, unquote, that they happen to be opposing. But this is what we feel back here. We feel these two sides of the coin, the one that says sober, sane attempt to force Iran to a better negotiating position once we ultimately get to negotiating, and we won't go to war. As I said before, this assumes you can control this process. I don't think you can. I think we're walking down the road to another use of military force that, like the one in Iraq, we will search historians, academics, forever for a national security decision document that says George W. Bush decided on war with Iraq. There is no such document. There's only the inexorable march to war. We're going to be seeing the same thing, I think, with Iran.
So, Colonel Wilkerson, I'm afraid that the phone connection is awfully bad here today with you. I'm just wondering if with any way we can call back or try a different line, or should we do that, or do a quick recall in case we get a better connection?
You can certainly try a call back.
We'll do it right away, because we obviously we don't want to keep our audience waiting.
Okay.
Okay. Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. Are you there, Colonel Wilkerson?
Is this better?
Yeah, oh, much, much better.
Okay.
You made a very clear case how dire the consequences are for an attack on Iran, and also how counterintuitive is our dealings with Iran by pushing them to the wall. And this bill does that. And it has the support, I believe, of something like 96 to 5 senators. It's an I don't see how the president can override, how he can sustain a veto. But we've also had the examples of the sacking of the British embassy by the Basiji militia, the religious police of the Iranian regime. And there are a lot of speculations now, as the U.S. gets out of Iraq, that some of the Iranian militias there in Iraq could go after the Green Zone or go after the consulate in Basra. Do you think that that there's a possibility that not just on the U.S. side provoking it, but a paranoid regime in Iran feeling threatened could strike out?
I do think that's a possibility. I particularly think it's a possibility with the IRGC in its capacity to direct elements of Iranian naval forces and the proximity of forces in the northern Indian Ocean. I'm praying that our commanders in the northern Indian Ocean, Marine Amphibious Task Forces, battle groups, and so forth, are instructed with ROE, or at least have developed their own rules of engagement that will allow them to back away from such a move and not get something started a la Tonkin Gulf or something like that. You could conceive of an IRGC commander or someone like that starting something without even instructions from Tehran. So just the proximity of forces, especially at sea, is a dangerous thing.
So what explains then, you were saying earlier that that there's a kind of fever going there on Capitol Hill, but the margin of 96 to 4 or something that voted for that particular amendment on putting the squeeze on Iran, there's no way the president can sustain a veto. He's apparently taking personal participation in these negotiations.
It's my understanding that with regard to the amendment we were talking about that allows the armed forces into essentially domestic law enforcement as long as it's related to terrorism or, quote, associated activities, unquote, that the reason that got applied to domestic situations, to U.S. citizens, in other words, is because of the White House. Carl Levin, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, actually was puzzled that when they had pulled the language out that would make it apply to U.S. citizens, very purposefully so, the White House insisted on the language going back in. So this is not only apparently something the White House won't veto, it's something that they made as bizarre as anything could be, in my view, putting the armed forces of the United States into a domestic role in terms of terrorism or associated activities. This borders on just short of declaring martial law for things related to terrorism.
But the military don't want this role, my understanding is.
That would be my strong understanding. The military already is roiling under its additional roles, which should be being done by civilian agencies, such as training police in foreign countries, such as holding military tribunals for people who should be in the Article III courts of this country. The military doesn't want these additional tasks. We're very fortunate that we have in the military people who understand the civil-military relationship in this country and the necessity for the military to stay subordinate in that relationship better than the rest of the country does. You won't find 10 people, if you go ask across the country, what is the civil-military relationship in the United States, who can give you a satisfactory answer. But you'll find almost every officer in the armed forces can. So we're very fortunate that we have an armed force like that. But we're pushing them. We're pushing them towards being different, and that's dangerous.
Well, some of the reporting suggested that the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, was involved in these negotiations. That's very, very puzzling, and it's the White House that wanted these provisions in. What is the White House threatening to veto over then? Is it the Iranian aspect of it?
That's my understanding.
So we have a president who's a constitutional lawyer, and he doesn't see the danger of eating away at the posse comitatus.
In my time, I've known a lot of lawyers advising the government of the United States in whatever guise, who knew the law inside and out. But in terms of understanding, wisdom, I might say, they possess none. I hope that's not the case with this president, but I must say that some of the things he's done, like increasing by tenfold the amount of times his Justice Department has used the national security argument in the Article III courts, like saying he's unable to close Guantanamo when closing Guantanamo would be simple as pie, like saying that we are actually moving towards a successful conclusion in Afghanistan. That's a total fabrication. But I can't believe that he's lying. He's simply being badly advised. And if you're being badly advised, you better be awfully smart to detect that sort of thing. He's smart technically, but I'm not sure he's smart in what I would call experiential ways. That is to say, he ain't been there and he ain't done it. So he hasn't got any idea when generals talk to him about Afghanistan, when they talk to him about the situation in Iraq or whatever, he's got no idea how to challenge them. And frankly, with Jim Jones gone and Tom Donilon in as National Security Advisor, he's got no one to help him.
But doesn't he want to get out of Afghanistan? And the long and the short of it is, there's no way to win that thing, is there? I mean,
no way at all in the traditional sense, and there's every way in the traditional sense to lose it. Not just blood and treasure expended for almost nothing, but at any moment we could see this sort of peripheral activity that's taking place now that created so many casualties in the last 96 hours or so turn into a really vicious civil war on the one hand between the Pashtuns and everybody else, and turn into a free-for-all with groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba and a host of others who are trying to grow up and fill al-Qaeda's shoes. So this could really turn into a mess, incidentally, that is right now strategically so unsound that it makes you just sit there and bite your nails. What do I mean by that? I mean that all of our logistics coming into that landlocked country are through someone else's auspices. If those someone else's, the Russians, the Pakistanis, or whomever, decide, as they have from time to time, that they want to stop those logistics, they could cut us off, and everybody we have in Afghanistan would be suddenly bound and determined to succeed only through airlift. And frankly, we don't have enough airlift without flying the wings off our C-5s, our C-17s, and everything else to carry out that kind of a Berlin airlift sort of operation with regard to all the troops we have, coalition and otherwise, NATO and otherwise, in Afghanistan. So this is a very untenable strategic situation, as well as being one that is not winnable.
So there's obviously an element of schadenfreude here. The Pakistanis hate us, and they're...
polls show about 90% of the Pakistan population, particularly in the federally administered tribal areas, the border area, 90%+ think they're number one enemies of the United States of America.
But doesn't that all of this sort of say we have to cut our losses? I don't see a way out of this, do you?
Nope. I would have come home yesterday.
Right. Well, look, we could talk a lot more, and I'm glad you've been able to join us here, Colonel Wilkerson. I'm sorry that the line wasn't so good at the beginning, but the long and the short of it is this is a moment for American citizens to wake up.
I'm reminded of Eisenhower's prescient speech in 1961, but not so much the military-industrial complex part, but the part where he says only a knowledgeable and alert citizenry. Only a knowledgeable and alert citizenry can take care of this, you know, all the problems he'd outlined. Well, those problems are just manifest today in ways not even he dreamed of. And do we have an alert and knowledgeable citizenry? Do we even have a media that can perform that task? These are dangerous times, in my view.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Colonel Wilkerson. Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, a retired U.S. Army colonel, former chief of staff to the United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. He also serves as deputy director and director of the U.S. Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. And in 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the terminally ill Hugo Chavez and what may follow his death.
This city is run by pigs. They take away the rights from all the kids. I walk down the street.
Este canto es para referirme a un hombre que cree que tiene el mundo entero en sus manos, no sabiendo que está muy equivocado y se le puede venir un hecatombe. Con ese armamento se cree un Superman. A Uribe y los gringos maldice y ultraja. El tiro le va a salir por la culata y como a Saddam Hussein le va a pasar. Deja la amenazadera porque tú lo sabes, Chávez, que se quita la.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Javier Corrales, who is a professor of political science at Amherst College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He's also the author of Dragons in the Tropic, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, and serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly. He's been a consultant to the United Nations, the Center for Global Development, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's also working on a book manuscript on constitutional reforms in Latin America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Javier Corrales.
Thank you for having me.
And the rumors are flying thick and fast in Venezuela. I've been speaking to people down in Venezuela, many of whom are fairly well connected, but they don't really want to go on the record. There's a sense of, I don't know what kind of political oppression we're talking about, but the long and the short of it is there's a great deal of rumors swirling around the impending death of Hugo Chavez. How do you gauge these rumors? Because he was on television just yesterday in a prolonged meeting, but he's apparently in a kind of cocoon controlled by Cuban intelligence, so it's hard to know what's going on. What's your reading on it, Javier?
These rumors have been going on since mid-2011 when Chavez officially announced that he was suffering from cancer. In many ways, the rumors are unavoidable, in part because the Venezuelan government treats this situation with utmost secrecy. Almost nobody knows exactly what is going on. The government has said, or Hugo Chavez has said, that he is cancer-free and recovering, but there's no question that his physical appearance has changed, and also that he is a less visible president. There is no question that he is ill and fairly disabled compared to what Venezuelans were used to prior to mid-2011. However, it's perhaps a bit premature to jump into any conclusions as to the gravity of his illness and the president's longevity. The president was very visible earlier this month when he hosted a meeting of Latin American presidents, and it is true that he has gone back into some type of behind-the-door mode of operation. But again, I wouldn't want to speculate beyond that about the president's health.
Well, Javier Corrales, I'm told from the people I talk to in Venezuela that some of them think he has as little as weeks to live. Now, you obviously have to discount these rumors because they are rumors, but on the other hand, the government is protecting him and there is this kind of cocoon. So, but the real question would be, though, if this prognosis is as bad as many suggest, he probably won't be around for the October elections, even though he's running now. The opposition elections to choose an opposition candidate begin in February. So clearly this is going to have an enormous impact on this upcoming election.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has already had an impact. The most important impact it has had thus far is that his own political movement, his Socialist Party, for the first time is beginning to think about questions of succession. This makes Chavez nervous, and this is a type of conversation that he's desperately trying to avoid. This is not what he wants to be happening, but it's almost inevitable at this point. So even if he survives, you have already seen the first consequence, which is a ruling party that begins to think of a world without its founding leader. If Chavez's health deteriorates and he needs to withdraw politically or even officially, there will be an important question as to whom will succeed him, will be the nominee. And at the moment, it is very difficult to gauge whom exactly Chavez will choose, or if it's done democratically, whom exactly the party will choose.
So the one thing that one keeps hearing from people in Venezuela is the enormous social anxiety about personal security, about the terribly high crime rate. And, you know, it really does affect people's lives. That's separate from the incredibly polarized politics in this country between the kind of Bolivarian circles, those who support Chavez, largely the poor people whose lives he's undoubtedly improved, and then the sort of the middle class and the old regime, etc. That's a pretty deadly mixture, isn't it? If you have political instability, you've got political polarization, and you've got a high crime rate.
Yes. The crime rate in Venezuela is so extraordinarily high. It's probably one of the highest in the world based on homicides. Just alone, that doesn't include other forms of crime. It is so high at the moment that it is no longer accurate to say that this only affects one sector of the population, an income group, or a region. It's everywhere. And it's beginning to affect even communities that were strongly behind the president. They're now heavily involved in this horrendous crime wave. And all polls suggest that this is now the most important issue in Venezuela. It is very important in most Latin American countries, no doubt about it. But it has risen to the very top in Venezuela. And the issue is interesting simply because in the 12 years that Chavez has been in office, there has been a policy of almost laissez-faire about crime. There isn't any type of real initiative. And so this is probably a liability for the government in a way that it wasn't before, simply because this is a government that hasn't produced a policy response as this issue has become a top priority for the vast majority of Venezuelans. It's important to be very clear that you know, Venezuela's cities, but also Venezuela's countryside, are extraordinarily dangerous even during daylight. The probability of suffering some kind of a form of petty crime or serious crime is very high.
Again, I'm speaking with Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College and the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. So what would explain the high crime rate, Javier, and what would explain Chavez's lack of response to it?
The expansion of crime has got to do with the fact that there is a system of impunity in Venezuela. You have the underlying conditions, the fact that there are economic needs to engage in crime, either because there's a lot of poverty or because there are enormous fortunes to be made through crime. But the key issue is that there is no systematic state response. People don't get, the police force is very unable to deal with this crime situation. The court system is unable to deal with the crime situation. So people rationally could conclude that the probability of getting caught or suffering some kind of sanction for engaging in crime is very low, and this, of course, creates an incentive. The second is, once you enter a crime wave, once you're a victim of crime, especially in poor neighborhoods, you then join the crime wave. You seek vengeance, you pick up arms, and so this tends to grow exponentially. But your question as to why Chavez has done very little about it, it's an interesting one. I think he realizes that he does not have the capacity to act, to deal with this in an effective way. And so to launch a war on crime with half-baked measures could backfire. And he has discovered that it is better to just let it go, make sure that the crime wave affects mostly non-state actors, which is what's happening now. And he has discovered that this is an easier way to live. He would not like to have a situation such as the one that President Calderon in Mexico is having, where they have decided to take on the issue of insecurity, crime, drug-related violence. But this has produced some kind of a backlash, and Chavez has said that he may not want to have this kind of a war on crime. But it can cost him electorally. That is no doubt the most important negative consequence of his decision.
So the fact that crime is now affecting his poor constituencies, that's what you're saying. I mean,
was he cynical about it?
But was he cynical about it in the sense that if crime was only affecting the wealthy and the middle class, he didn't do anything? But now that it's affecting his own people, he's going to pay a price.
He's going to pay a price electorally. But crime is still not affecting the most important aspects of Venezuela's economy, which is the oil sector. And this is the difference between being a petrostate and not being a petrostate. Crime is affecting the activities of the private sector. Definitely. But the oil sector remains immune from this crime wave. And because the regime depends so heavily on it, it can give a false sense of comfort on the part of the state officials, which is what is happening in Venezuela. You know, this is going to be an election in which, first, as serious as the crime wave is and as serious as the problem now is among and how it's affecting Chavez's supporter, he still has significant support. He does not have overwhelming support. This will not be an election that will be easy for Chavez to win. He might not even win it. But he's still competitive, right? So he may not feel that it is time to do something incredibly risky, like launching an uncertain attack on crime right now. Precisely because he's still electorally competitive, but at the same time, he doesn't face an assured victory. So he won't be risky, and so I don't think he will focus on a policy initiative to tackle crime.
But Javier Corrales, given that this consensus, at least from what I can find, from people in Venezuela, is the consensus is that he is terminally ill, and that it's very unlikely that he will be around in October. At some point during the elections, they're going to have to find another candidate. I mean, isn't that the period that one should be concerned about?
Oh, yes, you're completely right. I believe that there is going to have to be some kind of a search for a candidate, or at least for some kind of figure who could be in charge of the government, even if Chavez remains the nominal president, but the sort of like on some kind of medical leave or some kind of medical staying away. There needs to be a decision to be made as to who's going to be making some of the most important decisions. And at the moment, to my knowledge, this person hasn't been found or designated.
What about his brother, Chavez's brother, who's a governor?
Yes, he is. Alan Chavez is a governor, much more radical than Chavez, if that is imaginable. But constitutionally, he is not supposed to be in line for succession. The Constitution of Venezuela says that in the event of death, it's the vice president, and that is not a position held by Chavez's brother. If Adam Chavez were to become the preferred choice of Hugo Chavez, there will have to be some kind of either a change of the Constitution or a change in the cabinet.
And what role do you think the military will play in this? Because I understand that there are elements in the military that are very unhappy with the control that the Cubans, and particularly Cuban intelligence, have over both the inner circle, the envelope, if you will, around Chavez, and its influence over the military itself.
Next to Chavez's illness and next to Venezuela's finances, nothing is more non-transparent than civil-military relations in Venezuela at the moment. You're absolutely right in guessing that the military will play a role, but we know very little. There have been rumors going on for many years that several important policies by Chavez are unwelcomed by the military. Rumors exist, and yet the military has remained fairly loyal, or at least the upper echelon. There doesn't seem to be turmoil, at least visible to outside observers, visible turmoil in Chavez's relationship with the military. But there is no question that the military is perhaps the strongest player in Venezuelan politics at the moment, and that any conversations held at the cabinet level regarding a succession will have to obtain the green light of the military. To me, that's almost a given. But again, I wouldn't be able to tell you at this point what their preferred choice will be, only than to say that the military might play a key role here in at least the consultations pertaining to succession.
So just in closing, Javier Corrales, we haven't spoken about the opposition and who they are. And you know, for the longest time, of course, Venezuela was ruled by a kind of crony oligarchs, I guess. And Chavez, of course, always refers to those people in Miami, which is an allusion to the ancient regime who, you know, embezzled most of the oil money. Is he still able to sell that idea? Because it's apparently a pretty new opposition now.
This is an idea that still resonates with Chavez's supporter, but not with the rest of Venezuelans. It's been 12 years that we have had a Chavista government, and the opposition has evolved significantly. The current leaders are new actors, younger people who come from different political parties, who have had experience in government that has, at least two of them, have had experience in public administration that have been fairly reasonably executed. And so they have been able to overcome this image of being part of some kind of an ancien regime oligarchy. And so that is definitely worth mentioning. This is the best moment in the life of Chavez's opposition. They have never faced a more auspicious environment than they face right now. It's still an uphill battle, but this is a good moment for them. They're enjoying some kind of a renaissance, and it will be interesting to see whether they can capitalize on this good moment that they have. They're going to be having a primary, and the next challenge that the opposition faces is whether they're going to honor their pledge to respect the results of the primary. They need one candidate, a unified candidate. They know that if they go to an election divided, if there are two candidates of the opposition, that's the end of their chances of defeating Chavez. So the question will be, after the primary, if all the candidates, the candidates who lose the primary, will solidly stand behind the winner. That's going to be their next challenge.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today. Obviously, we're speculating about something that hasn't happened here, but with so much smoke in terms of rumors, there has to be a little bit of fire here. And at the risk of being ghoulish, I think it's important to talk about.
I agree, and I thank you for asking me to be part of this conversation.
Again, I've been speaking with Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez, and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. He serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly. He's been a consultant to the United Nations, the Center for Global Development, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's also working on a book manuscript on constitutional reforms in Latin America. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the connection between the Occupy movement and student debt.
I still owe money to the money, to the money I owe. I never thought about love when I thought about home. I still owe money to the money, to the money I owe. The floors are falling out from everybody I know. I'm on a blood.
You criticize the practice by murdering the plants, ignoring all the history, denying them romance. The pinstripe man of mourning are coming for to die.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Ross, who's professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University. He's also the author of Bird on Fire, Lessons from the World's Least Sustainable City. And he is one of the organizers of the Occupy Student Debt Campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Ross.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
And this year, student debt is approaching $1 trillion. And in this context, the White House apparently has just buckled under pressure from well-connected lobbyists representing the for-profit colleges. There's a very good article in Saturday's New York Times on the front page about this. What the article tells us, Andrew, is that this $30 billion predatory industry has been able to resist reform that the Obama administration promised. They more often than not provide students with a worthless education while saddling them with the mountains of debt. And many of these students are very poor and veterans. And this is an industry that has incredible friends on Capitol Hill that's allowed to make enormous profits as a private enterprise that's 90% funded by the taxpayer. I mean, isn't this a monstrous scandal?
It's immoral to say the least, and there will be a lot of champagne glasses being raised in toast whenever that volume of student debt reaches the $1 trillion mark, which it will do soon. Just as last year, the same glasses were being raised, not just in Wall Street, but also in certain sectors of government, when cumulative student debt surpassed consumer credit debt for the first time. These are some of the most lucrative loans you can make in the whole finance industry. And government, our federal government, I'm sad to say, has been an enabler, to say the least, of this predatory lending system that now basically supports the entire landscape of higher education. I mean, that's the most immoral part of it, that our educational institutions are totally dependent now on debt bondage, or what I think of as debt bondage.
But it's debt bondage for the student is scammed. They don't get the education as promised, and they don't get the jobs as promised afterwards, and instead they're servicing a huge debt for the rest of their lives. And the people that are making this happen, that leaned on the White House, who tried to do the right thing, you know, Anita Dunn, a close friend of the president's, of course, you know, Kaplan, which is one of the biggest for-profit operations, that's run by the Washington Post company. Maybe that explains. I don't want to offend the Washington Post. Apparently, Sperling, the head of Phoenix, University of Phoenix, he's a close friend of Nancy Pelosi's. You've got Richard Gephardt leading the lobbying effort, along with John Breaux, former Louisiana senator, and Tony Podesta, whose brother John was ran Obama's transition team. And so it goes. This is about how Washington operates, isn't it? You have the revolving door of people who trade in their public service for private gain. They then get the Congress to give money directly to these operations that then give them huge checks to essentially scam students. And how can they call it a private enterprise if 90% of it is federally funded?
Well, I agree with a lot of that analysis. It is a very well-connected racket, if you like to put it that way, and certainly that is the way it's being exposed these days. If we're talking about a regular consumer sector, in an advanced capitalist society, you would expect to see this kind of racket operating. It's pretty normative in most consumer sectors, especially in the military sector. But because it's in the realm of education, I think people, especially educators and arguably parents, many of whom have to foot this bill, are co-signers of the loans, and students increasingly themselves, they see this as particularly immoral because education is a this particular kind of good. Most people see it as a public good, and even those who see it as a private good would probably acknowledge that there are some private goods that ought not to be treated as market commodities. And so the issue really, and this is one of the issues our campaign speaks to, is whether paying for an education is the same as paying for a flat-screen TV. Whether loans should be treated as regular consumer loans, or whether we really need to set aside a different kind of category for lending, interest-free loans at the very least, for the university sector.
Particularly when you hear all these politicians, every time they run, they always say we've got to improve education. You know, George W. Bush was our education president. Obama was going to be our education president. Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Ross, professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University. He's the author of Bird on Fire, Lessons from the World's Least Sustainable City. That's Phoenix, Arizona. And he's one of the organizers of the Occupy Student Debt Campaign. Tell us about the Occupy Student Debt Campaign, because when I went down to Occupy LA and spoke with a lot of the people down there, a lot of them were students who first thing they were talking about was the mountains of student debt they have.
It's been a constant refrain at all Occupy locations. And we're not just talking about youngish people. Most student debtors are in their 30s or 40s. Many of them have gray hair at this point. We're talking about not just the most indebted generation in history, as it's often called these days, but at least a couple of generations. So we've been hearing this refrain constantly, and our working group at Occupy Wall Street decided to launch an action initiative in the form of a national campaign that would basically allow debtors to refuse debt, to sign on to a pledge of refusal to withhold the loan payments after a million others have signed up. So instead of suffering the agony and humiliation of debt and default in personal isolation, which is what's happening in mass numbers, we're offering an alternative for debtors to engage in a sort of collective act of dissent, a debt strike threat, if you like, and which we're hoping will have a public and political impact.
So do you think that the Occupy movement is being carried on campuses through this issue? That must be pretty, I mean, a lot of people always say, well, you know, the activism of the 60s is never going to return because it was driven in part by the fact that we had the draft back in the Vietnam days, and people were had a very personal stake in not being killed in a stupid war. Is there a sense of a personal stake in this issue?
Well, it's interesting you should mention that example, because at the Baruch College CUNY protest last week, a student publicly burned his debt collection letter from Sallie Mae. And I thought to myself, well, is this going to be the equivalent for this student generation of draft card burning for the anti-war movement in the 1960s? Certainly the sentiments and the momentum are there within on college campuses. I think we're only going to see this escalate. I hope we will, because it is an intolerable and unsustainable situation. I should mention our campaign is not just a pledge of refusal. It's also tied to several principles, one of which is that the federal government should cover the tuition costs of all 2- and 4-year colleges in the country. According to our estimate, it would cost a little more than $70 billion, which is actually a tiny slice of the federal budget, and would allow the U.S. to join the list of countries around the world, all of them less affluent than ours, which do provide free college education. We also are asking for interest-free loans, and in addition, for private universities to open their books. There's no justifiable reason in our eyes why private universities that are vast beneficiaries of federal largesse in all sorts of ways should be allowed to shield from public scrutiny their fiscal affairs. That's another important principle, we think.
Well, these for-profit colleges are enjoying sky-high profit margins, but I'm wondering, though, when you hear, particularly now in this presidential campaign, which is dominated by the Republican candidates, because they're the only ones running effectively against an incumbent, so much of the refrain is about getting government off our back, smaller government, how the virtues of the free market, that's what Mitt Romney keeps telling us. But this is an absolute disgrace here, what's going on with these for-profit colleges. This is federal money. They're 90% funded by the taxpayer. And the taxpayer would get so much better deal if they just gave this money out to these kids at low interest rates. And so that the kids wouldn't be stuck with this mountain of debt that weighs them down, particularly if they can't find a job because the diploma they got from these for-profit colleges is useless and they didn't get an education at any rate. I mean, I don't see – to me, this is so ideologically hypocritical. It's just, it makes me crazy.
The situation is definitely most acute and intolerable in the for-profit sector. In addition, these universities have the highest rates of non-completion of degree. And so we're seeing a whole generation of students carrying their debts off without even a degree to show for it. And these are debts that are pretty much unpayable. I mean, that's the bottom line here. We're in a fiscal situation where these debts are unpayable in people's lifetimes. And so we either have to wipe the slate clean, which is also what we're asking for, debt abolition on a massive scale. It happens every day with the banks, vast amounts of debt being written off. But when it comes to individual student debtors, they're not even allowed to declare bankruptcy, which is the most basic form of consumer protection. So you can find our campaign at OccupyStudentDebtCampaign.org, and it's fully laid out there, a lot of the principles. And that last principle about debt abolition is in, I think you'll find it appeals to an idea that's very commonly circulated throughout the Occupy movement, of a debt jubilee, which happens periodically in civilizations throughout history, whereby a ruling class perceives that the debts of the common people are simply unpayable and decides to wipe them off the books.
Well, but this one, you'd think, though, that maybe there's a movement, that should be a movement afoot to shame these shameless Congress people who take money from these for-profit lobbyists. Then they open up the treasury to them, and they put their fists in, they take federal dollars out, your dollars, our dollars, and then they get them for next to nothing, and then they charge these students these mafia vigorish loans. I'm just wondering about shame. Whether and all these lobbyists are all connected to a lot of them to the Democratic Party, they ought to be shamed, shouldn't they?
They should be shamed, I think they will be if initiatives like ours go forward. The first step, however, is to, as we see it, is to allow people, especially debtors, to empower themselves in some way rather than relying upon their demands to be addressed by corrupt lawmakers, which is a strategy that Occupy has rejected up until this point, and we are in agreement with that. Rather than that, give debtors, give the least powerful people and the most vulnerable people some kind of mechanism for empowering themselves through action.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Andrew Ross.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Ross, who's Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. He's the author of Bird on Fire, Lessons from the World's Least Sustainable City, and he's one of the organizers of the Occupy Student Debt Campaign. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we started out with Colonel Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff. He blew the whistle on the cabal, the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal responsible for torture. And, of course, we're back again with the Defense Authorization Act that's going to make Guantanamo even more important as opposed to closing it down. He analyzed the terrible aspects of this act in terms of its abuse of civil liberties, the crossing of the line with posse comitatus and having the military on our streets arresting people and citizens and detaining them indefinitely. He actually said that, in fact, this is coming from the White House, not from the Senate. The White House threatened to veto the bill over its provisions about Iran, which will probably lead to a war with Iran, as opposed to its abuse of civil liberties. That's a disturbing piece of information, but a lot more came out of that interview. Then we spoke with Javier Corrales, an expert on Venezuela. Chavez, of course, is terminally ill. There are rumors now that he is close to death. The long and the short of it is he probably won't be around long enough to run in October. And since there's no succession in place, things are likely to get very unstable in a country that's already racked with one of the worst crime rates in the world. And then finally, I spoke about the Occupy student debt movement with one of the founders of the movement, Andrew Ross. We talked about how student debt is reaching $1 trillion this year, which is greater than consumer debt, and how the efforts on the part of the White House to reform these for-profit colleges have absolutely been destroyed by the lobbyists, all of these politically connected lobbyists. This is an absolute disgrace. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.